Welcome to The Anxious Voyage. If you think that title sounds bleak or foreboding, one of two things must be true. You're very lucky, or you need to get out more. On this program, we share stories of life and living. We compare notes. We discover commonalities. We accept that life is a glorious, heartbreaking thing, and we embrace and celebrate all of it. Take the ride with us. We're glad you're here. Now, here's your host, Mark O'Brien.
Hello, hello. Welcome. We are indeed glad you are here. Sorry about that. We are coming to you, as most of you probably know already, from World Headquarters in Middletown, Connecticut, which is the home of this year's Rock and Roll Decibel Contest. And the winner will receive a pair of Liveo Edge rechargeable hearing aids from Starkey. So come out and ruin your hearing. My guest today is Tamsin Astor, and I am so delighted that you were willing to be with me today, Tamsin. Thank you very much.
Welcome, welcome. I'm excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Mark.
So I was looking into your background a little bit, and before I get to any specific things, I noticed that you earned a Bachelor of Science degree in psychology from the College of London.
University College London, yes.
University College London, there you go. So the first thing I would like to know is, and I think the theme of this conversation may be curiosity, but what made you curious to do that?
Couple of reasons. So I grew up in a home where my parents met studying psychology. Oh. And my father is a Jungian analyst. So I grew up in a home where conversations about people and what made them tick, what they were thinking about, what they were feeling, you know, social dynamics. We had artists, philosophers, musicians, architects, mixed race couples, queer couples around the dinner table. And I was encouraged from a very young age to participate in the conversation. And so I grew up in a home where thinking about ideas and people and what drives people and what motivates people, very much in line with curiosity, was sort of woven into my, you know, nurture, but is probably also deeply part of my nature. So when I was pondering what I wanted to do at university, and the British system is very different from the American system because you start zoning in at 14 when you pick 9 subjects. At 16, you pick 3 subjects. At 18, you pick 1. And if you want to change your major, you've got to drop out of the university and reapply again. So you have to go in with a very different lens than you do in the US. So, you know, I picked the science track because I thought I would totally go back and study history, French, geography, philosophy, you know, at 30 or 40, but there's no way I was going to go back and study biology and chemistry and math. So I picked the science track, and psychology allowed me to have a combination of the sort of art and science woven together. So I think that's how I landed on it.
Interesting. And then you decided to pursue a PhD.
I did.
And this is the point where I start to get really curious. So if I could, I just want to share a couple of things. And this is from your LinkedIn profile. I used the novel approach to examine a previously unanswered question regarding the relationship between the intentional and reactive motor system using pupil dilation and EEG. I framed my research from a philosophical standpoint, referencing William James, Descartes, and Kant. Intentional preparation facilitates the switching mechanism that exists between the intentional and reactive motor systems. This research impacts the understanding for disorders such as schizophrenia and Parkinson's. And I do want to say something about each of those three philosophical figures you mentioned. But how or why did you think to examine what you examined using those three people to form your perspectives?
So part of my undergraduate degree was a research project. And so 25% of my undergraduate degree was a research project that I did with this professor, Patrick Haggard. And I started answering this question as an undergraduate student and found the work and the concepts really interesting, this tangle between intention and reactivity. And so when I was finishing up my undergrad, most people in my psychology department were either going into advertising and marketing because, hi, we can understand stuff from the background of psychology and how to, you know, help people buy more deodorant or whatever it was, or were going into finance because we did a lot of math. And both of those seemed wholly unappealing to me. And I was in the kind of, maybe I can convince my parents to fund a year traveling around India stage of life as a 21-year-old, when my undergraduate supervisor said, I want to start taking on PhD students, graduate students. Have you thought about graduate school? And the way it works in the UK is you compose a question that's never been answered before, and you submit it to the board, and they review your hypothesis, what you would do, the value of it, why this question has not been answered, and then you get approved. And so that was actually how I ended up following that path. And so it was just a continuation of my undergraduate research that just sort of grew.
Okay, that strikes me as a rather simplistic answer. So I'm just going to start chronologically here. And I would, until I did this little bit of research, I wouldn't have remembered when these people lived. But Rene Descartes was born in 1596. It's actually, when I saw that, it surprises me that he's still so influential. Anyway, he developed the first modern version of mind-body dualism. So I suspect that's how and why that was important to you. A new science grounded in observation and experiment. He's the founder, ostensibly, of modern philosophy. He dismissed apparent knowledge derived from authority, the senses, and reason, and erected new epistemic foundations on the basis of the intuition that, when he is thinking, he exists. This he expressed in the famous dictum, I think, therefore, I don't have any idea in the world what's going on around there. And Immanuel Kant was born in 1724. He developed a comprehensive and systematic work in epistemology, the theory of knowledge. Ethics and aesthetics greatly influenced all subsequent philosophy. He subsumed new trends that he had begun with the rationalism, stressing reason, of Descartes, and the empiricism, stressing experience, of Francis Bacon. That surprised me a little. Blah, blah, blah. He thus inaugurated a new era in the development of philosophical thought. My favorite quote from him is, "The death of dogma is the birth of morality." Wow. We could certainly use that around here. And now, and William James, I recall, was, I think he was considered to be the father of American pragmatism. And the quote from him that I always remember is, "Organization and method mean much, but contagious human characters mean more." So when I was preparing for this show and I was reading that stuff, that made me all the more curious as to how and why you chose those three figures to be the basis for your dissertation.
Well, I mean, they were part of the basis. I mean, when you are creating a foundation to do research, what you have to look for is an argument for why this is an interesting question. Who has attempted to answer this question in the past? And, you know, what did they figure out? So, you know, those were the big thinkers in that space. But I also used, physiological data, neuroscience data, you know, examples of people with specific kinds of brain injury. Like one of my favorite ones was alien hand syndrome, where when people have a particular lesion in the brain, one hand will do something and the other hand will do something else. So they'll be sitting there, hot cup of coffee, and their brain is going, "Don't pick it up, it's too hot." But the alien hand will just grab the cup because of the lesion in the brain that shows this bifurcation between intentionality and reactivity in the human cortex and the motor cortex, right? So I, you know, back to that question, is I chose them because, you know, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, over a 300-year period, these were kind of key figures who tried to, or, you know, look at the conversation, question, understanding of what does it mean to have volition? What does it mean to have any sense of free will in the way we move and the way we function in society? And of course, you know, I was taking it down to the most basic motor function, right? A key press, right? To try and make it as simplistic as possible. And then I was looking at, you know, who else had looked at this and thought about this and tried to make sense of this?
Wow, a few things just jumped into my head. Maybe a little bit facetiously. I wonder if there have been any instrumentalists like keyboard players or piano players who've had alien hand syndrome. because on the one hand, I obviously I play guitar, but the idea of playing piano when one hand is doing something completely different from the other, that makes my head swim. But it's at least arguable, I suppose, that alien hand syndrome, if properly managed, could be an advantage.
Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of fascinating disorders like that too. Like the one that I find fascinating is synesthesia, where you experience another sense through the sense than you normally would, right? So colors might be associated with sounds or smells, right? So there's a sort of miswiring in how your senses understand and approach and make sense of the world. And that's, you know, and some of the parent, I can't remember the list of them. I remember reading a book 20 years ago about famous people, sort of creatives in the world, who had more than one sense experience in their creative pursuits, which I you know, so I think that there are, you know, and we understand now as we think more about neurodivergency, that this concept of like there is the right way and the, you know, the formal way and the, you know, preferred way of understanding how we work. And I'm kind of like, yeah, no, not so much anymore. I think we've moved beyond that way of thinking, or not completely, but we're on the track.
You know what? I'm really glad you explained that too, because now I understand why I can smell my coffee with my ears. I didn't think that was normal until right now. Thank you. I also wonder if in your examination of free will, did any of Friedrich Nietzsche's thinking come into play? And I'll tell you specifically what I'm wondering about. He wrote, I can't remember the book, but he wrote that free will was what he called the theologian's artifice, invented to be able to impute guilt. That also at least calls to mind for me Kant's notion of dogma. Mm-hmm. What did that play into your thinking or research at all?
I didn't. I mean, because I was not in the philosophy department. So the philosophy was really the, you know, who tried to get at this question before the psychologists and the neuroscientists. You know, I was at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience. So I was keen to get to the neuroscience and not get weighed down too much in the philosophy. So I, with conversations with my professor, you know, limited the amount of philosophy that I was going to get into, because I hadn't done a philosophy undergraduate. I was in no way, you know, a philosophy expert. So I was just, you know, digging into the philosophy as a basic framing. And to be honest, I find reading philosophy a challenge. It's not something. And since graduate school, I have not read philosophy, because it's not something that I struggle with the incredibly long, multi-clause sentence philosophers tend to get wound into. So no, I mean, I remember, you know, sort of skimming some Nietzsche and then deciding to zone in on those three, because for me, the way they wrote made the most sense to me, and their arguments for this distinction between intention and reactivity, which is what I ended up calling my thesis, was more clear and obvious to my sciencey brain.
I think reading philosophy is supposed to be challenging. And I can remember one undergraduate course in philosophy in which we were relentlessly splitting this hair ever more and more finely, and I must have looked troubled or something. Because the professor said, "Oh, Brian, what the hell are you thinking?" And I said, "You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking this is why people adopt faith. Because at some point you can just stop all that examination and say, this, I believe this. Might not even have to be a religious faith, but, you know, some faith, and here we go again. Okay, is faith different from dogma? I don't know. That's a philosophical question.
Well, I think the point as well is you have to be interested in the challenge, right? Yeah, and so I would call out that as yes, it, you know, for me that's not a challenge that was interesting to me to pursue. So I decided not to continue to pursue something. Whereas I think there are other challenges that we can dig into that are in like the challenge is worth it because where we're going with it and the struggle is more inherently, you know, engaging.
I remember reading one time that the most important characteristic of an endurance athlete is to be able to tolerate pain. Mm. And I think the most important aspect of being a philosopher is you just have to reconcile yourself to the fact that you're never going to know.
Right. Right.
You're just going to keep going. And I suppose I understand why, or maybe how, that could be satisfying. So you said that you were not in the philosophy department. You were in the neuroscience department. That suggests research to me. Mm-hmm. So at what point, and I'm guessing considering the fact that you also got an executive coaching certification in emotional intelligence and resonant leadership, that suggests to me that at some point, maybe research wasn't floating your boat anymore.
So yeah, I mean, I pursued my PhD, which was research heavy. I then decided that I wasn't going to stay doing research in this tiny little area of the brain because I was not having immediate impact on people's lives. I was contributing to a body of knowledge that might help people down the road, but that separation was not sufficient for me. So my postdoctoral fellowship, I moved into a space of education where I was on a large National Science Foundation grant, which was museum. It was five school districts, four museums, and three universities looking at how do we do science professional development in schools versus universities, and how are we supporting the underserved communities. It was in St. Louis, at Washington University in St. Louis. I spent 2.5 years doing that, came out of that realizing that the politics of academia were not for me for a number of reasons. One, I didn't like the heavy sway towards research to the behest of teaching, as in if you're a good academic, you buy out your teaching and you do very little teaching so you can do research. And I loved teaching. I loved engaging and communicating and supporting that nurturing environment. And the fact that that was frowned on and seen as like the laborious part of academia, I didn't suit my personality. I didn't like the battle for funding, this constant sort of scarcity model around getting the money, getting published, peer reviewed, getting the money, getting, you know, that to me. And then the politics of the department was also something that I struggled with, because there's this expectation, as in many careers, that because you're good at a subject, you know how to manage people, you know, and you keep moving up there. So those were the reasons that for me, I was like, I don't think, even though, you know, I loved the combination of teaching and research, the kind of introverted and extroverted engagements. The all of that other stuff to me weighed too heavily, which is why I left the academy.
Wow. I have two questions. I'll start with this one, and we may or may not get to the second one before the break. Did you find the politics of academia to be different in the UK from the way it is in the United States?
A little bit, partly because in the US, it takes longer to get there, right? You know, it takes longer to get your undergraduate degree. It takes longer to get your PhD. So particularly for women, there's a very different pathway, particularly the sort of whole mummy track bullshit that we have to deal with as women, that, you know, it's when can I take time off to have a child, right? So that was one of the things that was very clear to me in the difference between the American and the British system. And then I think some of the other politics that I noticed were different were around the financial aspects of it. But I mean, I left the academy in 2006. So it's not something that I've engaged with intimately. And I'm sure that, you know, in nearly 20 years. So I'm sure there's been a lot of changes since then that have swung more or less in one. But given that we are still one of only two countries in the world that has no paid maternity leave, you know, I maybe not.
Okay, that's a good point. And so we will get to my other question. I don't know if the connection that gets made here is philosophical or neuroscientific, but how in the world does the notion that you're good at something lead to the expectation that you can manage people?
I don't know, but you see it in all careers, right? You see it everywhere, this idea that just because you are good at able to do something, that you can then manage people doing that. Managing people is a completely different skill set. And I think this concept that you can manage teams in different kinds of businesses and transfer between different businesses makes more sense to me than just that you are climbing the ladder. And I think the other thing that is also really clear, you know, my uncle was an OBGYN in the British system. And, you know, he loved complicated pregnancies. You know, that was his speciality. And he was like, I don't want to manage people. I just want to do what I love to do, which is work with my patients. And it was that constant battle. You know, you've been doing it longer, you're doing it longer, you know, you're good at this. And just because I'm good at something doesn't mean I like it. It's that nexus, right, of the being good at it, enjoying it, making money, that a lot of us struggle with in that space. But I really don't know where that mistake came in. And I think one of the things that I saw in my undergraduate and PhD graduate school departments was a few people specifically said, you know, if we are going to continue in this space, please, can we have some kind of management personnel training, because we are going to be expected to run labs ourselves if we stay in this path and have graduate students and so on, and manage the funds and manage the, you know, the rooms that people use and manage schedules. Please, can we have some training in this? Because this is not, you know, this is not the same thing. I don't know where this fallacy came from, Mark.
It reminds me, I'll share this and then we'll jump to the first break. The last job that I had before I woke up and went to college at age 28 was I was working in an appliance distribution warehouse. And before I took the job, they made me take this like intelligence aptitude test. My first day on the job, I had to unload, and this was in late August in the hot sun, I had to unload a 40-foot box trailer full of television sets by myself. And at one point, the operations manager who had given me this intelligence test came out to the warehouse. And I'm standing there completely soaked in perspiration. And I said to him, can I ask you a question? Why did you give me that intelligence aptitude test instead of a physical? What in the world made you think I could do this? All right. So we will take our first break. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. We'll see you then.
Everybody has a story. Everyone's story deserves to be told. And the only bad stories are the ones we don't share. That's why Mark O'Brien created The Anxious Voyage. It's Mark's conviction that every story deserves to be shared. And his purpose is to give people in all walks of life, from any circumstances, a chance to tell their stories. The Anxious Voyage is now on syndicated Dream Vision 7 radio network every Monday at 1 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern Time, with live broadcast every first and third Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please tune in, please join Mark, and please share your stories.
Ever wonder what it's like to have your own radio show? Well, wonder no longer, because you can dip into the radio airwaves by being host for the day on syndicated Dream Vision 7 radio network. It's a fabulous way to get your radio feet wet. It's an opportunity to market your business, modality, or book, have a guest, mention a sponsor, and take callers. Or you may want to facilitate a lesson by going solo. It's up to you. Listeners can be online, mobile, in cars with Bluetooth, or listen through Amazon's Echo by asking, Alexa, play Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more details, go to dreamvision7radio.com and click on Host for the Day.
You can't can't establish your brand's authority without a voice. That's why, since 2004, O'Brien Communications Group, OCG, has been helping companies establish their authority, find their brand's distinct voices, and position their brands effectively and persuasively. So effectively that 9 of OCG's clients have been acquired by other companies. OCG's business model emphasizes efficiency and results, not hourly billing, markups, and media commissions. That ensures OCG's advice is unbiased and its clients aren't at financial risk. If you're ready to find your voice and use it to tell your story, OCG is ready to help. You can find O'Brien Communications Group on the web at obriencg.com. That's obriencg.com. Or call 860-944-9022.
Calling all authors. Have you been considering an audiobook? Well, look no further. Come take advantage of DreamVision 7 Radio Network's unique in-house audiobook production, which includes benefits and bonuses from our radio station. Let our knowledgeable staff guide you to create the audiobook you've always dreamed of without breaking the bank. Check out our full one-stop service from A to Z, including the ACX process. Schedule a free consultation by calling 508-226-1723. That's 508-226-1723. Or go to DreamVision7Radio.com.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.
Welcome back, everyone, and welcome back, Tamsin. During the break, I was back there looking for one of my favorite books, which is exactly the reason why I couldn't find it. but it's called If You Meet the Buddha on the Road, Kill Him. And it's written by a psychotherapist from things he learned in the course of his practice. And the notion, of course, is if you think you've found the answer to whatever it is you're seeking externally, that's probably not the answer. So given what you now do, and as the habit doctor, I'm guessing that your work ideally compels people to do a great deal of introspection. What do they learn and what do you learn?
Oh, that's a big question. So, so a couple of things. And I love that you referenced that book. I love that book too. I've been a Buddhist for 11 years nearly. One of the things that they learn to do is to take agency back. A lot of people have lost their sense of agency. And that I really mean around a couple of things. One is really, what kind of life and business are you creating for yourself? A lot of people get stuck in, I have this degree, I have this marriage, I live in this place, this is my gender, this is my whatever. And they get stuck in a track, and they get stuck in shoulds as well around, I should look this way, I should like this, I should continue with this because I've got student debt, for whatever it is, right? We should all over ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And that then creates a lot of discomfort and pain in people's lives. So what people learn when they work with me is to redefine their life on their own terms, redefine their big juicy vision on their own terms, and then create the habits to get there. And one of the surprising things, so often the habits are mundane or not particularly interesting. They are, you know, around a lot of self-care. So starting and ending the day on your own terms, meditation, mindfulness, journaling, exercise, eating well, sleeping well, managing your relationships well, understanding and working on your boundaries. So stuff that can feel like, oh, I don't want to do that, or not particularly mind-blowing in its concept. But one of the things that a lot of my clients say to me, which for me is a big reason that I do this work, is around, I like myself more, I trust myself more, I make decisions more easily because they have started to cultivate a deep sense of inner knowing and self-trust. And that's what a lot of this work is really about, is understanding what it is that you enjoy, what lights you up, that nexus between, you know, doing something that you love, making money and that you enjoy, right? And then taking the actions to make that happen. You know, one of my clients ended up creating a 7-figure business. She took her family off to, and went, lived in Africa for a year, you know, did things that when we started working together didn't feel possible, right? And so that's one of the things that I, you know, have seen that my clients have learned. One of the things that I think I have learned from doing this work is, you know, similar to the, you know, if you see the Buddha on the road, like there is no perfect solution. And that the vision we have at one point of our lives that we think might be the vision that we have forever may completely be upended. And so I think one of the things that I've had to roll with a lot, but partly or hugely related to how my children's lives have turned out, is, you know, the vision that I had for my life has completely shifted. So I've had to reframe all that based on things that were nothing to do with me, right? And nothing to do with the way I was showing up, and all to do with things that I had no control over. So I then had to go, okay, now how do I redefine that vision? So I think the sense that, you know, you figure it out and you're golden, you know, is bullshit, right?
Yeah, I wonder, and I completely understand what you're saying about having to reframe, and you know, I think most of us, certainly many of us, grow up with certain sets of expectations. Mm-hmm. There's sets of expectations that come from others. There's sets of expectations that we impose on ourselves. But when I think about the notion of agency, which I actually find myself thinking a lot about, I wonder, given this, given some of the things that you encourage in your practice, I wonder if it's chicken and egg. And what I mean is, do you have to start with some fundamental sense of yourself and then adopt practices to bring that to fruition? Or can it be the other way around, or both, or a combination?
So, you know, that's an interesting question, because one of the bits that I've struggled with in my business is creating a, you know, a digital program to sell, because I don't do the same formula with every single client, because every single client who comes to me, you know, shows up with a different set of, you know, concerns and, you know, things to work through. And, you know, sometimes in the coaching space, you'll see a lot of people who'll say, if you don't fix the mindset, doesn't matter what the hell you do, you're never going to be able to be successful. And I've seen that with some clients, that it's really about the self-talk. And when I talk about mindset, I talk about it from the internal, like how you think about yourself, your sense of agency, how you talk to yourself, your concepts around self-worth, and how you navigate the energy, words, you know, impact of those around you, and how much you let those affect your ability to show up, right? But then sometimes the best way into change is not by changing the way you think, but it's the fake it till you make it model. It's the, if I get up every day and move my body and follow through these things and show up in these communities and do these things, I will then potentially change my mind about how I feel about myself and my efficacy and my ability to achieve, right? And so that's, so the fact that, you know, people are different and the access point into change is different, for me, is a really fundamental part of this whole process, right? Is that, you know, for some people it's one and others. So for some people it's the chicken, and for some people it's the egg, Mark, is what I would see in response to that, and having worked with so many people over the years.
And I wonder, and I will, I'll share this with you. There was a point in my life, I was working in a corporate gig. I had to wear a suit and tie to work every day. I had put myself through school starting at 28 after having played music and worked odd jobs for 10 years, et cetera, et cetera. And a guy that I worked with said, given where you are today and given all that you've done and accomplished to get here, don't you feel like you're still putting something over on someone? And I said, yes, I do. And you know, today we would probably jump to say, oh, that's imposter syndrome. But I wonder if it's possible, if you do have that fundamental, I don't know what, conception of yourself, faith in yourself, I wonder if you really can fake it until you get to the point at which you can, I don't know, realize that vision of yourself, self-actualize or something. I actually suspect that's what I did. Mm-hmm. And it took me a really long time. I mean, I was significantly lost until well into my 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And all I knew to do was to stay the course, mm-hmm. and not give up on whatever that thing was that I believed in myself.
Yeah. And I mean, I fundamentally believe in our ability to continue to show up in ourselves and commit to our own dreams. But the, you know, an interesting point that I think is also really, I think that we're starting to see a lot more data on, and I think it's also a really important part of this conversation, is who you choose to be around. Because what we know now is the contagion of divorce, obesity, happiness, exercising, you know, all of these things are socially contagious, right? Whether it's the, when I got divorced, people not wanting to hang out with me because they were like, oh shit, I don't want to look at my own relationship, to the, when I'm happy and I impact the person next to me to be happy, it spreads. And I forget, it's like, it spreads up to like 5 miles or something. There's some really funny data on social contagion. And so I think a really important part of this is that we don't operate in a vacuum. And so when we think about the behaviors and habits and how we're showing up, and then our mindset is who are you spending time with? We're the average of the five people we spend the most time with. Are we spending time with people who are moving towards the goals that we are trying to achieve, who have the kinds of habits, who have the way of looking at the world that we, you know, ascribe to, or that we desire to follow through on, or that we're trying to get to? Or are we spending time with people who are backward looking, small thinking, negative, fill in the blank, right? And so that for me is also a really fundamental part of this conversation, is who are we surrounding ourselves with, and not just what we're doing on our own.
I think it also has to do with what we can learn from the people we're around. And I'm going to share something with you, and then we may actually need to come back to it after our next break. But I recently became aware, I'm going to say within the last 2 weeks or less, of the fact that a guy that I've known since I was 5 years old is in, and ended up in, sort of a convalescent facility that's very near where we live now. So once I found out that he was there, and he'd been there since July and I didn't know it, I've gone to see him every day. And I'm actually intrigued by the way I feel myself evolving. And I can explain more of this to you later offline, but I'm going to do a session on April 23rd that I'm calling Hope, Control, and Letting Go. And it's, I think it's very much connected to the expectations that I had when I started going there, that mm-hmm. he wanted to get well, mm-hmm. that he would want to get out of there, mm-hmm. That he would want to get back to some semblance of a normal life, which actually he hadn't lived for 17 years or more. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that has as much to do with me as it does with him. Mm-hmm. So while I take your point about the contagion, and you know, one of the things that ran through my mind was, because of where I live, I had not been an active member of a gym for, oh boy, 15 years or something. And I know not being in a gym changed me, and not for the better. But I also see value in what I'm learning from being exposed to this friend after 17 years. I mean, I've known this guy for 65 years. So, it's crazy. So I'll tell you what, we'll think about that while we take this next break, and then we'll come back and we'll do our final segment. See you shortly.
Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com.
You can't establish your brand's authority without a voice. That's why, since 2004, O'Brien Communications Group, OCG, has been helping companies establish their authority, find their brand's distinct voices, and position their brands effectively and persuasively. So effectively that 9 of OCG's clients have been acquired by other companies. OCG's business model emphasizes efficiency and results, not hourly billing, markups, and media commissions. That ensures OCG's advice is unbiased and its clients aren't at financial risk. If you're ready to find your voice and use it to tell your story, OCG is ready to help. You can find O'Brien Communications Group on the web at obriencg.com. That's obriencg.com or call 860-944-9022.
Calling all authors. Have you been considering an audiobook? Well, look no further. Come take advantage of Dream Vision 7 Radio Network's unique in-house audiobook production, which includes benefits and bonuses from our radio station. Let our knowledgeable staff guide you to create the audiobook you've always dreamed of without breaking the bank. Check out our full one-stop service from A to Z, including the ACX process. Schedule a free consultation by calling 508-226-1723. That's 508-226-1723. Or go to DreamVision7Radio.com.
Everybody has a story. Everyone's story deserves to be told. And the only bad stories are the ones we don't share. That's why Mark O'Brien created The Anxious Voyage. It's Mark's conviction that every story deserves to be shared, and his purpose is to give people in all walks of life, from any circumstances, a chance to tell their stories. The Anxious Voyage is now on syndicated Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Monday at 1 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern Time, with live broadcast every first and third Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please tune in, please join Mark, and please share your stories.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.
Sorry about that. You know what I've discovered? I've discovered that this microphone right here is very, very much like my car. It doesn't work unless you turn it on. So I'm trying to get the hang of that. While we were on the break, I was thinking about what I shared with you just before that. And I was thinking about the relationship between two things: regret and judgment. Mm. And I wonder if regret isn't largely the product of our being judged by others and ourselves. And I wonder the extent to which that interferes with our manifesting our own agency.
But this makes me think of Marcus's quote that I love, which is, we judge others by their actions. We judge ourselves by our intentions. And how we very much, and I see it, you know, the in the world of anxiety that so many of us occupy in this day and age, right? That yep. the way that we judge our intentions, you know, versus do we judge our actions or the actions of others, and how we show up in the world. And I think there is, it's very easy to get stuck in that rear view living. And I think one of the things that was really striking to me when I went through my divorce, which is nearly a decade ago now, was I actively sought out people who were divorced when I was going through it, because I wanted to understand what it would look like on the other side. And I found people falling into very different sort of buckets about their experience. You know, the people who were had the very strong sense that being married was the natural state and this was a blip and that they were going to find the next person, right? You know, that kind of like, oh, you know, we'll find another one, you know? And then others who had this idea that, you know, it was so awful and so painful that they were going to shut down a part of who they were. And, you know, whether that looked like, you know, not dating again, whether it looked like, you know, all men, women, whatever are evil, bad, you know, and sort of boundarying them, like creating a sort of mental headspace around, you know, the person that they'd divorced, you know, or, you know, dating people that they knew they couldn't be successful with because fill in the blank, this person didn't want to get married, was already married, had some, you know, you know, whatever. And I remember, you know, finding those two groups and thinking, I don't think I fall in either of those groups. And then continuing to, you know, look out and finding people who were open to falling in love again and thinking, oh, that these are more my people, right? And I think that there is the way that I understand it is, I was like, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life looking in the rearview mirror and going, what if, you know, why did I do this? Why did I not do that? All of the mistakes and regrets, right? But I also didn't want to just be looking forward. Like, you got to incorporate the past into where you're going. So for me, it was really about the learning, right? What did I not listen to? Where did I, you know, lose a part of myself? Where was I not trusting my intuition or my gut? Where did I, you know, and factoring that into moving forward. So I think this whole idea about regret and shame and agency is really woven into, or is really, for me, I think really about this balance between learning from the past and moving forward. I mean, like the Buddha said on his deathbed, you know, don't believe anything I've said, go out and explore, right? So, you know, yes, you've heard my stories, but go forth and engage in the world on your own terms, you know?
Yeah, and create your own stories. There's a brilliant routine. I don't know if you've ever seen it. A comedian named Gary Gulman was on Conan O'Brien, and he did a brilliant routine about the people who were trying to create all the two-letter abbreviations for the United States. And they got so frustrated, he said they hired a contractor. No. They hired a contractor. And he said, you've probably never heard of this guy, but you're familiar with his work. And one of the things he said was, he's the guy who invented would have, could have, should have, the holy trinity of regret, which is just brilliant. And then this may seem nuts to you, but we had a small group of people here one year on New Year's Eve. And we have a little dog, a 9-pound Chihuahua French bulldog mix named Eddie, who's just the most gentle soul. And there was one gentleman here, his name was Mike, and he was sitting with Eddie in his lap, and he clearly was just loving it. And I said, Mike, how could you not have a dog? And he said, I'll never have another dog. And I said, why? And he said, because it's only going to die. And I didn't say this to him, but my first reaction was, why would you deprive yourself of everything that could be derived while the dog's alive? Mm-hmm. I mean, that remarkable unconditional love and loyalty, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel the same way about divorce, having been there myself.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just simple fear of missing out. I don't know. But I do know I could never make the choice to harden myself like that.
Right.
Did any of that go through your mind?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, I am, it's a little bit like, you know, one of the conversations I've had, you know, a little bit with my therapist over the years is I have, my natural state is to trust people until they prove to me they can't.
Me too.
And I've been hurt, you know, because of that. And at one point, my therapist, we're having a conversation, he's like, you're just so gullible, you know? And I was like, that's who I am. Like, I choose to go into the world with the view that people are going to be kind until they show me that they're not. And I had a similar conversation with somebody. I went on a date a few years ago with a guy who, special needs teacher, musician, and I live in Ohio. And it was when one of the concealed carry laws had gone through. This mind, I grew up in London where, you know, when we had a semi-automatic shooting, you know, the British government changed the laws, right? And my father, who had a shooting, had a rifle that he used once every 5 years, they came to our house, checked that there was a safe that my brother and I could not access. So I grew up in a very different world with respect to guns, right? Mm-hmm. So we were having this conversation and this guy, you know, who met what I thought a lot of my sort of ideologies, said, I never leave my house without a gun. I have a concealed carry at all times and have done since the 90s. And I was very taken aback and I asked him why. And he explained that he'd had multiple limbs broken, loading his equipment into the back of his truck, leaving a gig, you know, in the 90s, you know, he'd had his nose broken, arm broken. And in those days you could get certified as a concealed carry owner if your job put you in danger. And so we then had a conversation, which for me is why I'm drawing this, is that I said to him, I would never want to be somebody who walked around all the time with a gun, because that would mean that I would have to change my view of humanity. I would have to go out into the world expecting to need to protect myself or others. And, you know, as a woman who grew up with a body that was sexualized from the age of 11 and who's, I've experienced a lot of, you know, abuse, you know, I'm tall and curvy and I grew up in central London taking public transport. I've not been a human since I was 11. I've been a woman since I was 11, right? I understand on one level the desire to protect myself, but that mindset shift of going out every day into the world with the expectation that I need to protect myself to the point of having to pull a gun, to me just seems so unappealing and so extremely different from the way that I want to view the world and I want to view society and I want to view my fellow humans. So I think for me, it's really about a mindset that I choose to embody, right?
Yeah, I've never thought about that psychological shift before. I was having a conversation fairly recently with a guy who's just a brilliantly talented artist. And He didn't go quite so far as to tell me that I was nuts because I didn't own a gun, but he told me that he never leaves his home without one. Mm-hmm. And all I could think was, if I ever had to pull the trigger, and you got to think about that for a moment, right? Because the moment of pulling the trigger is not one of a whole lot of conscious reflection. Mm-hmm. But if I ever had to do that and the person that I shot didn't survive, I don't have the vaguest idea how I could live with that. Wouldn't matter the circumstances. Yeah. I took a life. That's just, I couldn't do that. So I completely understand what you're saying about that. And another interesting thing is my brother-in-law is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and served 34, 35 years of active duty. He does not own a gun.
Mm.
And I thought, wow. If that guy who knows that much more about the world than I do doesn't own a gun,
yeah,
I should be taking notes.
Yeah.
We are coming to the end of our program. We need to be done by 58 minutes after the hour so Rachel can be on to her next program. But I can see that you've done a very good job of promoting yourself and your business by your background. So aside from TamsonAster.com, is there any other way that people can get a hold of you? And is there anything else about your practice you'd like to share?
Oh, big juicy question. Yes, so I'm on LinkedIn and Facebook, but mostly, yep, LinkedIn is where I show up most of the time. And I am shifting into working with organizations, which I'm really excited about, because one of the things that I've started to really realize is the power of community around all of this work.
Wow.
And one of the things that I love to do is facilitate groups who are, you know, working with the challenge of, you know, what does it look like to create a big juicy life on my own terms? What does it look like to reframe my habits based on, you know, maybe there's a group who fall into a category like, you know, widows, trainee doctors, women with, you know, a particular situation going on in their lives. I am really skilled at working with groups together, looking at, understanding, supporting, challenging with the big question. So that's a space that I'm actively growing my business, because there's something really powerful about the work in community paired with the work on your own. And I think that because we are naturally social beings, creating spaces where we can dance between the two is really where my passion and business and joy is moving towards, because those are all woven together.
Thank you for sharing that. One of the reasons I'm absolutely positive I will never grow old is that I'm perpetually naive. So I say this a little bit guardedly, but I really do think that I see some kind of wheel turning, and we are coming back to the realization of the importance of community. Mm. And if nothing else, being with others will keep us from being so self-preoccupied.
Yeah.
So that, for what this is worth, that strikes me as a very sensible change of course. So thank you. I also thank you for being here today. I'm going to reserve the right to invite you to come back. This was a delightful conversation, and I'm sure in reflection, I'm going to think of so many other things I would love to talk to you about. So I hope you'll accept that invitation.
I would love that. Thank you so much, Mark. Okay. I've really appreciated the chance to chat here today.
Thank you very much. And for all of you who happen to be listening, I will be back 2 weeks from today with a beautifully talented artist named Amy Labossière. And I hope you will join us then. Thank you again, Tamsin.
Thank you for tuning into The Anxious Voyage, the program dedicated to sharing stories, helping people, and celebrating life. You can see and listen to The Anxious Voyage on syndicated Dream Vision 7 radio network every Monday at 1 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern Time, with live broadcast every first and third Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. If you have a story to tell, or if you know someone who does, please email the host, Mark O'Brien, at mark@obriencg.com. In the meantime, please remember, the only bad stories are the ones we don't share.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.